this is the source, as certainly all of modern biology suggests, of the complexity and beauty of the biological world. This sort of argument from design, we can find in other aspects of nature, and I'd like to discuss two of them. One is Isaac Newton's understanding of the order within the solar system, and the other is the most interesting, although I believe flawed, approach to the laws of nature put forth in recent times called the anthropic principle. One of Newton's many extraordinary accomplishments was to show that, granting a few simple and highly non-arbitrary laws of nature, he could deduce to high precision the motion of the planets in the solar system. The Newtonian method has remained valid from that time to this. It is precisely Newtonian physics that is used routinely in my line of work, sending spacecraft to the planets, something that you might be tempted to say was far beyond Newton's expectations, but he in fact did envision at least the launching of objects into Earth orbit. What Newton found is that there is a distinctive plane to the solar system. Copernicus had essentially proposed this, but Newton showed in detail how it worked. The orbits of the planets circle the sun, all of them very close to the ecliptic plane, also called the zodiacal plane, because the constellations of the zodiac are arrayed around this plane. And that's why the planets and the sun and the moon apparently move through the zodiac. "Why is everything so regular?" Newton asked. "Why are all the planets in the same plane? Why do they all go around the sun in the same direction? It's not that Mercury goes around one way while Venus goes around in another way. All of the planets go around in the same sense. And, as far as he knew then, they all rotated in the same sense. The planets had something astonishingly regular about them. On the other hand, the comets that were known in his day were helter-skelter. Their orbits were at every possible angle to the ecliptic plane. Some went around in the direct sense, some went around in the retrograde sense, and they were tilted in all sorts of directions." Newton believed that the distribution of cometary orbits was the state of nature, and that is how the planets would have moved had there not been an intervening hand. He believed that God established the initial conditions for the planets that made them all go around the sun in the same direction, in the same plane, and rotating in a compatible sense. Now, in fact, this is not a strong conclusion. And Newton, who was extraordinarily perceptive in so many areas, was clearly not here. The outline of a general solution of this problem was provided independently, as far as we can tell, by both Immanuel Kant and by Pierre Simon, the Marquis de Laplace. Newton, Laplace, and Kant all lived after the invention of the telescope, and therefore after the discovery that Saturn has an exquisite ring system that goes around it, a flat plane of clearly fine particles. The first clear demonstration that it's made of many particles, that it isn't a solid sheet, was made by a Scottish physicist, James Clerk Maxwell. Upon a closer view of the rings of Saturn in the accompanying PDF, you can see an enormous sequence of such rings and a gap, the so-called Cassini division, in the rings. We now know that there are many hundreds of these rings, all in a flat plane, and we now know, as both Kant and Laplace guessed, that they're made of tumbling boulders and dust particles. The rings of Saturn, by the way, are thinner compared to their lateral extent than is a piece of paper. Kant also knew about objects that were then called nebulae. It was not clear whether they were within our Milky Way or beyond. We now know, of course, most of them are beyond. Some of the nebulae were again flattened systems made, we now know, of stars. So Kant and Laplace, both of them explicitly mentioning the rings of Saturn, and Kant explicitly mentioning the elliptical nebulae, proposed that the solar system came from such a flattened disk and that somehow the planets condensed out of the disk. But if that's the case, the disk, after all, has some rotation. Everything that condenses out of it will be going around in the same direction. And if you think about it for a moment, you will see that as the particles come together and make larger objects, they will have a common sense of rotation as well. What Kant and Laplace proposed is what we now call a solar nebula, or accretion disk, whose flattened form was the ancestor of the planets, and that it is perfectly easy to understand how it is that the planets are in the same plane with the same direction of revolution and the same sense of rotation. What is more, we now know that the random orientation of the comets is not primordial, and that very likely the comets began in the solar nebula, all going around the sun in the same sense, were ejected by gravitational interactions with the major planets, and then by the gravitational perturbations of passing stars, had their orbits randomized. So Newton was wrong in both senses. A, in the sense of believing that the chaotic distribution of cometary orbits is what you would expect in a primordial system, and B, in assuming that there is no natural way in which the regularities of planetary motion could be understood without divine intervention, from which he deduced the existence of a creator. Well, if Newton could be fooled, this is something worth paying attention to. It suggests that we, of doubtless inferior intellectual accomplishment, might be vulnerable to the same sort of error. For a visual representation of the solar nebula, see the PDF that accompanies Chapter 2. I would like now to come to what is called the anthropic principle. If you study history, it's almost irresistible to ask the question, what if something had gone in a different direction? What if George III had been a nice guy? There are many questions. That's not the deepest, but you understand what I'm saying. There are many such apparently random events that could just as easily have gone another way, and the history of the world would be significantly different. Maybe, I don't know that this is the case, but maybe Napoleon's mother sneezed and Napoleon's father said, "Gesundheit," and that's how they met. And so a single particle of dust was responsible for that deviation in human history. And you can think of still more significant possibilities. It's a natural thing to think about. Now, here we are. We're alive. We have some modest degree of intelligence. There is a universe around us that clearly permits the evolution of life and intelligence. That's an unremarkable and, I think, as secure a remark as can be made in this subject, that the universe is consistent with the evolution of life, at least here. But what is interesting is that in a number of respects, the universe is very fine-tuned, so that if things were a little different, if the laws of nature were a little different, if the constants that determine the action of these laws of nature were a little different, then the universe might be so different as to be incompatible with life. For example, we know that the galaxies are all running away from each other, the so-called expanding universe. We can measure the rate of expansion. It is not strictly constant with time. We can even extrapolate back and ask how long ago were all the galaxies so close that they were in effect touching. And that will surely be, if not the origin of the universe, at least an anomalous or singular circumstance from which we can begin dating. And that number varies according to a number of estimates, but it's roughly 14,000 million years. Now, the period of time that was required for the evolution of intelligent life in the universe, if we are unique and we define ourselves immodestly as the carriers of intelligent life, a case could be made, you know, for other primates and dolphins, whales, and so on. But for any of those cases, it took something like 14,000 million years for intelligence to arrive. Well, how come? Why are those two numbers the same? Put another way, if we were at a much earlier stage or a much later stage in the expansion of the universe, would things be different? If we were at a much earlier stage, then there would not be, according to this view, enough time for the random aspects of the evolutionary process to proceed. And so, intelligent life would not be here. And so there would be nobody to make this argument or debate about it. Therefore, the very fact that we can talk about this demonstrates, it is argued, that the universe must be a certain number of years old. So, if we only had been wise enough to have thought of this argument before Edwin Hubble, we could have made this spectacular discovery about the expansion of the universe just by contemplating our navels. There is, to my mind, a very curious ex post facto aspect of this argument. Let's take another example. Newtonian gravitation is an inverse square law. Take two self-gravitating objects, move them twice as far apart. The gravitational attraction is 1/4. Move them 10 times farther apart. The gravitational attraction is 1/100, and so on. It turns out that virtually any deviation from an exact inverse square law produces planetary orbits that are, in one way or another, unstable. An inverse cube law, for example, and higher powers of the negative exponent mean that the planets would rapidly spiral into the sun and be destroyed. Imagine a device with a dial for changing the law of gravity. I wish there was such a device, but there isn't. We could dial in any exponent, including the number 2 for the universe we live in. And when we do this, we find that a large subset of possible exponents leads to a universe in which stable planetary orbits are impossible. And even a tiny deviation from 2.0001, for example, might, over the period of time of the history of the universe, be enough to make our existence today impossible. So one may ask, how is it that it's exactly an inverse square law? How did it come about? Here is a law that applies to the entire cosmos that we can see. Distant binary galaxies going around each other follow exactly an inverse square law. Why not some other sort of law? Is it just an accident? Or is there an inverse square law so that we could be here? In the same Newtonian equation, there is the gravitational coupling constant called Big G. It turns out that if Big G were 10 times larger, its value in the centimeter gram second system is about 6.67 times 10 to the negative 8th. If it were 10 times larger, 6.67 times 10 to the negative 7, then it turns out the only kind of stars we would have in the sky would be blue giant stars, which expend their nuclear fuel so rapidly that they would not persist long enough for life to evolve on any of their planets. That is, if the time scales for their evolution of life on our planet are typical. Or, if the Newtonian gravitational constant were 10 times less, then we would have only red dwarf stars. What's wrong with a universe made with red dwarf stars? Well, it is argued they're around for a long time because they burn their nuclear fuel slowly, but they are such feeble sources of light that to be warmed to the temperatures of liquid water, let's say, then the planets would have to be very close to the star in order to be at this temperature. But if you put the planets very close to the star, there is a tidal pull that the star exerts on the planet so that the planet always keeps the same face to the star. And therefore, it is said, the near side will be too hot and the far side will be too cold, and it's inconsistent with life. So isn't it remarkable that Big G has the value it does? I'll come back to this. Or consider the stability of atoms. An electron with something like 1/1800th the mass of a proton has precisely the same electrical charge. Precisely. If it were even a little different, the atoms would not be stable. How come the electrical charges are exactly the same? Is it so that 14 billion years later, we, who are made of atoms, could be around? Or if the strong nuclear force coupling constant were only a little weaker than it is, you can show that only hydrogen would be stable in the universe and all the other atoms, which surely are required for life, we would say, would never have been made. Or if certain specific nuclear residences in the nuclear physics of carbon and oxygen were a little different, then you could not build up in the interiors of red giant stars the heavier elements. And again, you would have only hydrogen and helium in the universe, and life would be impossible. How is it that everything works out so well to permit life when it's impossible to imagine quite different universes? What I'm about to say now is not an answer to the question I've just posed. It is not difficult to see teleology hiding in this sequence of arguments. And in fact, the very phrase anthropic principle is a giveaway as to at least the emotional, if not the logical, underpinnings of the argument. It says something central about us. We're the anthropos. And that's the reason I'm saying that this is another ground, somewhat covert, on which the Copernican conflict is being worked out in our time. J.D. Barrow, one of the authors and promoters of the anthropic principle, is quite straightforward about it. He says that the universe is designed with the goal of generating and sustaining observers, namely us. Now, what can we say about this? Let me make, in conclusion, a few critical remarks. First of all, in at least parts of this argument, there is a failure of the imagination. Let's take that red dwarf argument, in which if the gravitational constant were an order of magnitude less, then we would only have those red giants. Is it true that you could not have life in that situation for the reasons I mentioned? It turns out it isn't, for two different reasons. Let's look again at that tidal-locking argument. Yes, for a close-in planet and the star, it seems possible that the net result would be the same kind of situation as for the moon and the Earth, namely that the secondary body makes one rotation per revolution, therefore always keeping the same face to the primary. That's why we always just see one man in the moon and not some woman in the moon on the back that we see as well. But if you look at Mercury and the Sun, you find a close-in planet, not in a 1-to-1 resonance, but it's a 3-to-2 resonance. There are many more than just this one kind of resonance that are possible. What is more, if we're talking about planets that have life, we're talking about planets with atmospheres. A planet with an atmosphere carries the heat from the illuminated to the unilluminated hemisphere and redistributes the temperature. So it's not just the hot side and the cold side. It is much more moderate than that. And then let's take a look at the more distant planets that you might imagine were too cold to support life. This neglects what is called the greenhouse effect, the keeping in of infrared emission by the atmospheres of the planet. Let's take Neptune, at 30 astronomical units from the Sun, so you would figure that it has almost 1,000 times less sunlight. And yet, there is a place we can see with radio waves in the atmosphere of Neptune that is as warm as it is in the cozy room I'm in. So what has happened here is that an argument has been put forward, but in insufficient detail. It has not been looked at closely enough, and I bet that will turn out to be the case in some of the other examples I present. The second possibility is that there is some new principle hitherto undiscovered, which connects various apparently unconnected aspects of the universe in the same way that natural selection provided a wholly unexpected solution to a problem that seemed to have no conceivable solution whatever. And thirdly, there is the so-called many worlds, or better, many universes idea. And this is what I had in mind when I was talking about history at the beginning. Namely, that if at every micro instant of time the universe splits into alternative universes in which things go differently, and that if there is at the same moment an enormously, tremendously large, perhaps infinitely large array of other universes with other laws of nature and other constants, then our existence is not really that remarkable. There are all those other universes in which there isn't any life. We just, by accident, happen to be in the one that has life. It's a little bit like a winning hand at bridge. The chance of, let's say, being dealt 12 spades is an absurdly low probability, but it is as likely as getting any other hand, and therefore, eventually, if you play long enough, some universe has to have our laws of nature. Well, I believe that we are seeing a still largely unexplored area of physics being projected upon by the same sorts of human hopes and fears that have characterized the entire history of the Copernican debate. I wanted to say just two final things. One is, if the very strong version of the anthropic principle is true, that is, that God, we might as well call a spade, created the universe so that humans would eventually come about, then we have to ask the question, what happens if humans destroy themselves? That would make the whole exercise sort of pointless. So if only we could believe the strong version, we would have to conclude either A, that an omnipotent and omniscient God did not create the universe, that is, that he was an inexpert cosmic engineer, or B, that human beings will not self-destruct. Either alternative, it seems to me, is a matter of some interest would be worth knowing. But there is a dangerous fatalism lurking here in the second branch of that fork in this road. Well, I would like to conclude, then, by just a few lines of poetry, this one from Rupert Brooke, called Heaven. Fish, fly replete in depth of June, dawdling away their watery noon. Ponder deep wisdom, dark or clear, each secret fishy hope or fear. Fish say they have their stream and pond, but is there anything beyond? This life cannot be all, they swear, for how unpleasant if it were. One may not doubt that, somehow, good shall come of water and of mud, and sure the reverent eye must see a purpose in liquidity. We darkly know by faith we cry, the future is not wholly dry. Mud unto mud, death eddies near. Not here the appointed end, not here. But somewhere beyond space and time is wetter water, slimier slime. And there, they trust, there swimmeth one who swam ere rivers were begun. Immense of fishy form and mind, squamous, omnipotent and kind, and under that almighty fin, the littlest fish may enter in. Oh, never fly conceals a hook, fish say in the eternal book, but more than mundane weeds are there, and mud celestially fair. Fat caterpillars drift around, and paradisal grubs are found, unfading moths, immortal flies, and the worm that never dies. And in that heaven of all their wish, there shall be no more land, say fish. 3. The Organic Universe. Once upon a time, the best minds of the human species believed that the planets were attached to crystal spheres, which explained their motion both daily and over longer periods of time. We now know this is not true in several ways, one of which is that the Copernican theory explains the observed motion to higher precision and with a more modest investment of assumptions. But we also know this is not true because we have sent spacecraft to the outer solar system with acoustic micrometeorite detectors, and there was no sound of tinkling crystal as the spacecraft passed the orbits of Mars or Jupiter or Saturn. We have direct evidence that there are no crystal spheres. Now, Copernicus did not have such evidence, of course, but nevertheless, his more indirect approach has been thoroughly validated. Now, when they were believed to exist, how was it that these spheres moved? Did they move on their own? They did not. Both in classic and in medieval times, it was prominently speculated that gods or angels propelled them, gave them a twirl every now and then. The Newtonian gravitational superstructure replaced the angels with GMM over R squared, which is a little more abstract. And in the course of that transformation, the gods and angels were relegated to more remote times and more distant casualty skeins. The history of science in the last 5 centuries has done that repeatedly, a lot of walking away from divine micro-intervention in earthly affairs. It used to be that the flowering of every plant was due to direct intervention by the deity. Now, we understand something about plant hormones and phototropism, and virtually no one imagines that God directly commands the individual flowers to bloom. So as science advances, there seems to be less and less for God to do. It's a big universe, of course, so he, she, or it could be profitably employed in many places. But what has clearly been happening is that evolving before our eyes has been a god of the gaps. That is, whatever it is we cannot explain lately is attributed to God. And then, after a while, we explain it, and so that's no longer God's realm. The theologians give that one up, and it walks over onto the science side of the duty roster. We've seen this happen repeatedly. And so what has happened is that God is moving, if there is a real God of the Western sort. I am, of course, speaking only metaphorically. God has been evolving toward what the French call un roi fainéant, a do-nothing king who gets the universe going, establishes the laws of nature, and then retires or goes somewhere else. This is not far at all from the Aristotelian view of the unmoved prime mover, except that Aristotle had several dozen unmoved prime movers, and he felt that this was an argument for polytheism, something that is often overlooked today. Well, I want to describe one of the most major gaps that is in the course of being filled in. We cannot surely say it is fully filled in yet, and that has to do with the origin of life. There was, and in some places still is, a very intense controversy about the evolution of life, about the scandalous suggestion that humans are closely related to the other animals, and especially to non-human primates, that we had an ancestor who would be, if we met it on the street, indistinguishable from a monkey or an ape. A great deal of the attention has been devoted to the evolutionary process, where, as I tried to indicate earlier, the key impediment to its being intuitively obvious is time. The period of time available for the origin and evolution of life is so much vaster than an individual human lifetime that processes that proceed at paces too small to see during an individual lifetime might nevertheless be dominant over 4,000 million years. One way to think about this, by the way, is the following. Suppose your father or mother, let's say father for the sake of definiteness, walked into this room at the ordinary human pace of walking. And suppose just behind him was his father, and just behind him was his father. How long would we have to wait before the ancestor who enters the now open door is a creature who normally walked on all fours? The answer is a week. The parade of ancestors moving at the ordinary pace of walking would take only a week before you got to a quadruped. And our quadruped ancestors are, after all, only a few tens of millions of years ago, and that's 1% of geological time. So there are many different ways of calibrating this immense vista of time that was necessary to evolve the complexity and beauty of the natural world. And this is one. Now, the evidence for evolution is ubiquitous, and I will not spend a great deal of time on it here. But just to remind everyone, the centerpiece is, of course, the fossil record. Here we find a correlation of geological strata, otherwise identifiable and datable by radioactive dating and other methods, with fossils, the remains of hard parts, of organisms largely now extinct. If you looked at an undisturbed sedimentary column, the remains of human beings will be found only in the very topmost layers. The farther down you dig, the farther back in time you are going. And no one has ever found any remnant of a human being down in the Jurassic or the Cambrian or any of the geological time periods other than the most recent, the last few million years. And likewise, there are many organisms that were absolutely dominant and abundant worldwide for enormous periods of time that became extinct and were never seen again in the higher sedimentary columns. Trilobites are an example. They hunted in herds on the ocean bottoms. They were enormously abundant, and there have not been any of them on the Earth since the Permian. In fact, by far, most of the species of life that have ever existed are now extinct. Extinction is the rule. Survival is the exception. When you look at the fossil record, it is clear that some organisms have powerful anatomical similarities with others. Others are more distinct. There is a kind of taxonomic evolutionary tree that has been painstakingly developed over a century or more. But in recent times, it is possible to look for chemical fossils to examine the biochemistry of organisms that are alive today. And we are even just beginning to know something about the biochemistry of organisms that are extinct because some of their organic matter can nevertheless be recovered. And here, there is a remarkable correlation between what the anatomists say and the molecular biologists say. So the bone structure of chimpanzees and humans is startlingly similar. And then you look at their hemoglobin molecules, and they are startlingly similar. There's only one amino acid difference out of hundreds between the hemoglobins of chimps and humans. In fact, when you look more generally at life on Earth, you find that it is all the same kind of life. There are not many different kinds. There's only one kind. It uses about 50 fundamental biological building blocks, organic molecules. By the way, when I use the word organic, there is no necessary implication of biological origin. All I mean when I say organic is a molecule based on carbon that's more complicated than CO and CO2. Now, it turns out that with trivial exceptions, all organisms on Earth use a particular kind of molecule called a protein as a catalyst, an enzyme to control the rate and direction of the chemistry of life. All organisms on Earth use a kind of molecule called a nucleic acid to encode the hereditary information and to reproduce it in the next generation. All organisms on Earth use the identical code book for translating nucleic acid language into protein language. And while there are clearly some differences between, say, me and a slime mold, fundamentally, we are tremendously closely related. The lesson is, don't judge a book by its cover. At the molecular level, we are all virtually identical. This then raises interesting questions about whether we have any idea of the possible range of life, of what could be elsewhere. We are trapped in a single example and have not the imagination to guess even one other way in which life might exist when there might be thousands or millions. Certainly, no one deduced from fundamental theoretical chemistry the existence and function of nucleic acids when they were all around us and, in fact, when we ourselves were made of them. Now, how did it come about that these few particular molecules out of the enormous range of possible organic molecules determine all life on Earth? There are two main possibilities and a range of intermediate cases. One possibility is that these molecules were somehow made preferentially in great abundance in the early history of the Earth, and so life just used what was lying around. The other possibility is that these molecules have some special properties that are not only germane but essential for life, and so they were gradually developed by living systems or preferentially removed from a dilute to a concentrated solution by them. And, as I said, there is a range of intermediate possibilities. It would be wrong to say that the origin of proteins and nucleic acids is identical with the origin of life, and yet nucleic acids are known in the laboratory to replicate themselves and even to replicate changes in themselves from plausible building blocks in the medium. It is true that an enzyme is needed for this reaction in the laboratory, but this enzyme determines the rate and not the direction of the chemical reaction. So it merely shows us what would happen were we willing to wait long enough. And there was surely plenty of time for the origin of life, which I will come back to as well. It is certainly conceivable that what we have today is quite different from what was present at the time of the origin of life. We have today a very sophisticated kind of life, evolved by natural selection, that was based upon something much simpler much earlier. It has been proposed that much simpler might in fact be mainly inorganic, or it may have been organic. There is no way to be sure. But one thing is undoubtedly of interest for the origin of life, some would say essential, and that is to understand where the molecular building blocks that are present in all living things today came from. So we now come to the issue of organic molecules. They are found on the Earth, of course, but since the Earth is littered with life, we do not have a clean experiment. We don't know, or at least it's not immediately obvious, which organic molecules we see on the Earth are here because of life, and which would be here even if there had not been life. And virtually all the organic molecules that we see in our everyday lives are of biological origin. If you want to know something about organic chemistry on the Earth prior to the origin of life, it's a good idea to look elsewhere. The idea of extraterrestrial organic matter is important not just for this reason, but also because it tells us something relevant, at least about the likelihood of extraterrestrial life. If it turns out that there is no sign of organic molecules elsewhere, or they're extremely rare, that might lead you to conclude that life elsewhere was extremely rare. If you found the universe bushing and overflowing with organic matter, then at least that prerequisite for extraterrestrial life would be satisfied. So it's an important issue. It's an issue where remarkable progress has been made since the early 1950s, and it speaks to us, I believe, if not centrally, at least tangentially, about our origins. The astronomer Sir William Huggins frightened the world in 1910. He was minding his own business, doing astronomy, but as a result of his astronomy, the work I'm talking about was done in the last third of the 19th century, there were national panics in Japan and Russia and much of the southern and midwestern United States. 100,000 people in their pajamas emerged onto the roofs of Constantinople. The Pope issued a statement condemning the hoarding of cylinders of oxygen in Rome. And there were people all over the world who committed suicide, all because of Sir William Huggins's work. Very few scientists can make similar claims, at least until the invention of nuclear weapons. What exactly did he do? Well, Huggins was one of the first astronomical spectroscopists. Please refer to the accompanying PDF for pictorial representations of astronomical spectroscopy. A single grain of potassium cyanide on the tongue will instantly kill a human being. Discovering cyanide in comets worried people. especially when it appeared that in 1910, the Earth would pass through the tail of Halley's Comet. Astronomers tried to reassure people. They said it wasn't clear that the Earth would pass through the tail, and even if the Earth did pass through the tail, the density of CN molecules was so low that it would be perfectly all right. But nobody believed the astronomers. Perhaps the Earth did pass through the edge of the tail. In any case, the comet came and went, nobody died, and in fact, nobody could detect a single additional molecule of CN anywhere on the Earth. William Huggins, however, did die at the time that the comet came by, but not of cyanide poisoning. Now, when we look closely at a comet, there is a tiny nucleus, the solid body that constitutes the comet everywhere, except when it's very close to the sun. The icy nucleus is typically a few kilometers across, but when it comes close to the sun, the icy nucleus outgasses mainly water vapor and produces the coma and a long and lovely tail. Consider the molecules we have just talked about. CN, C2, C3, NH2. What are their parent molecules? Where do they come from? There are some precursors. We are seeing only fragments that have been chopped off of a bigger molecule by ultraviolet light from the sun and the solar wind. It is clear that there is a repository of much more complex molecules, much more complex organic molecules that are part of the cometary nucleus, but which we have not yet discovered. Radio astronomical studies have already found HCN, hydrogen cyanide, and CH3CN, acetonitrile, and at least one comet. And these are interesting organic molecules that in other ways are implicated in the origin of life on Earth. Imagine the air in front of your nose, highly magnified, say 10 million times. You would see a multitude of molecules, nitrogen and oxygen molecules, and occasional molecules of water vapor and carbon dioxide. Air, as you know, is mainly oxygen and nitrogen. Now, if you take some air and cool it, you will progressively condense out the various molecules. Water will condense out first, carbon dioxide next, oxygen and nitrogen much later, that is, at much lower temperatures. Let's consider the condensation of the water molecule. When condensation happens, it's not just that the water molecules drop out of the air helter-skelter. In fact, they form a lovely hexagonal crystal lattice, which stretches off as far as the ice crystal or snowflake or wherever it goes. Other molecules condense out at much higher temperatures, like silica, for example, silicon dioxide, which also forms a crystal lattice. Let's go back to the solar nebula from which, as we said earlier, the solar system almost surely formed, with a proto-sun in the center and the temperature declining the farther we get from the sun. Now, we must imagine this is a mix of cosmically abundant materials, including water, H2O, which we know through spectroscopic analysis of astronomical images is very abundant. Methane, CH4, we know that's very abundant. Silica, SiO2, we know that's very abundant. And what happens is that at different distances from the sun, different materials will condense out because they have different vapor pressures or different melting points. And what we see is, guess what? Water condenses out roughly at the vicinity of the Earth, whereas silicates condense out closer to the sun. So liquid silicates or gaseous silicates are not to be expected under ordinary planetary conditions, even at the orbit of Mercury. Whereas you have to go out to somewhere near the present distance of Saturn before methane condenses. Now, methane is probably the chief carbon-containing molecule in the cosmos. And what this says is that in the early stages of the formation of the solar nebula, there should have been a preferential condensation of methane in the outer parts of the solar system, but not in the inner parts. And if that is generally true, then we ought to expect more organic matter in the outer parts and much less in our neck of the cosmic woods. Well, there is certainly not a huge amount of methane on the moon or Mercury, but when we do go out to the orbit of Saturn, we start finding not only evidence for methane, the planets Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune have lots of methane in their spectra, but we find a set of data that strongly implies the presence of complex organic molecules in the outer solar system. Go to the accompanying PDF for photographic illustrations on organic molecules. To continue the story about organic matter in the outer solar system, the best story by far, the one that we have the most information on, although it is still quite limited, is for Titan. Titan is the largest moon in the Saturn system. It is remarkable for many reasons, the most striking of which is that it is the only moon in the solar system with a significant atmosphere. The surface pressure on Titan, we know from Voyager 1, is about 1.6 bars, that is, about 1.6 times what it is in the room I am in as I write this. Since the acceleration due to gravity is about 1/6 on Titan what it is here on Earth, there is 10 times more gas in the titanium atmosphere than in the terrestrial atmosphere, which is a substantial atmosphere. The organic molecules found in the gas phase in the atmosphere of Titan by the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft include hydrogen cyanide, HCN, which we've talked about before, cyanoacetylene, butadiene, cyanogen, which is two CNs glued together, propylene, propane, which we know, acetylene, ethane, ethylene. These are all components of natural gas. Methane, likewise. And the principal constituent of the atmosphere, there as here, is molecular nitrogen. It is, I think, very interesting that we have a world in the outer solar system that is loaded with the stuff of life, and we can calculate, at the present rate at which these materials are being formed on Titan, how much of this stuff has accumulated during the history of the solar system. The answer is the equivalent of a layer at least hundreds of meters thick all over Titan, and possibly kilometers thick. The difference depends on how long a wavelength of ultraviolet light can be used for such synthetic experiments. And, incidentally, there is also a range of entertaining evidence that there is a surface ocean of liquid hydrocarbon at Titan. So just think of that environment. There's land. Probably there's oceans. The land is covered with this organic muck that falls from the skies. There is a submarine deposit underneath this ocean of liquid ethane and methane, of more of this complex stuff, and then down deep is frozen methane and frozen water and so on. Now, that's a world worth visiting. What's happened to that stuff over the last 4.6 billion years? How far along has it gotten? How complex are the molecules there? What happens when occasionally there is an external or an internal event that heats things locally and melts some ice and makes some liquid water? Titan is a world crying out for detailed exploration, and it seems to be a planetary scale experiment on the early steps that here on Earth led to the origin of life. But there on Titan were very likely frozen literally at the early stages because of the general unavailability of liquid water. Likewise, there is a very stunning range of studies, mainly in the last 2 decades, of interstellar organic matter, not just a multiplicity of worlds in our solar system, but the cold, dark spaces between the stars are also loaded with organic molecules. Looking toward the center of the galaxy in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius, you can see a set of dark clouds, some quite extensive, some much smaller. It is in these giant molecular clouds that well upwards of 50 different kinds of molecules have been found, most of which are organic. And it is precisely in such dark clouds that the collapse of solar nebulae is expected to happen, and therefore the forming solar systems should be composed, in part, of complex organic matter. The conclusion is that complex organic materials are everywhere. Now, let's return to the question of the origin of life on Earth. The organic stuff could have fallen in during the formation of the Earth, or it could have been generated in situ from simpler materials on the Earth in the same way as on Titan. At the present time, there is no way of assessing the relative contributions from these two sources. What seems clear is that either source would be sufficient, adequate. The Earth formed from the collapse of lumps of matter of the sort we talked about earlier, condensing from the solar nebula. Therefore, in its final stages of formation, it was collecting objects that collided at high velocity and produced a set of catastrophic events, including the melting of much of the surface. This, it turns out, was not a good environment for the origin of life, as you might have suspected. But after a while, when the final sweeping of the debris in the solar system was more or less completed, water delivered from the outside or outgassed from the inside started forming on the surface, filling in the ancient impact craters, and a trickle of material was still falling in from space. At the same time, the electrical discharges and ultraviolet light from the sun and other energy sources produced indigenous organic matter. The amount of organic matter that could have been produced in the first few hundred million years of Earth history was sufficient to have produced in the present ocean a several percent solution of organic matter. That is just about the dilution of Noor's chicken soup, and not all that different from the composition either. And chicken soup is widely known to be good for life. In fact, it is just this warm, dilute soup, in the words of J.B.S. Haldane, who was one of the first two people to realize that this sequence of events was likely, in which the standard scenario for the origin of life occurs. In the laboratory, we can take molecules of water, ammonia, and methane, rather like the ones we've been talking about for Titan, and dissociate them by ultraviolet light. The fragments make a set of precursor molecules, including hydrogen cyanide, which then combine and in water form the amino acids. In such experiments, not just the building blocks of the proteins, but the building blocks of the nucleic acids are routinely produced. There is a range of subsequent experiments in which the smaller molecular building blocks join together to form large and complex molecules. If we look at the fossil record, we find that there is a range of evidence for microfossils dating back not just to the beginning of the Cambrian, but dating back to as much as 3,500 million years ago. Now just think about these numbers. The Earth itself forms about 4,600 million years ago. Because of the final stages of accretion, we know that the Earth environment was not suitable for the origin of life back then. From studies of the late cratering on the moon, it looks, since the Earth and the moon were presumably in the same part of the solar system, then as now, as if the Earth was not in a suitable state for the origin of life until perhaps 4,000 million years ago. So, if the Earth is not appropriate to the origin of life until 4,000 million years ago, and the first fossils are around 3,500 million years ago, then there are only about 500 million years for the origin of life. But those earliest fossils are by no means extremely simple organisms. They are, in fact, colonial algal stromatolites, and a great deal of evolution had to precede them. And that, therefore, says that the origin of life happened in significantly less than 500 million years. We don't know how much less. 6 days was once a popular hypothesis. It's not excluded by these data, but at least it cannot be as long as 500 million years. It must have happened very fast, a process that happens quickly is a process that in some sense is likely. The faster it happens, the more likely it is. There's a difficulty in extrapolating from a single case. Nevertheless, this evidence suggests that the origin of life was in some sense easy, in some sense, sitting in the laws of physics and chemistry. And if that's true, that is a very important fact for the consideration of extraterrestrial life. There is a classic objection to this kind of argument about the origin of life. As far as I know, this objection was first posed by Pierre Lecomte de Nuit in a 1947 book called Human Destiny, and is regularly rediscovered about once every half decade. It goes something like this. Consider some biological molecules. Not all of them. We'll give the evolutionists the benefit of the doubt. Let's just take a small, simple one, not something thousands of amino acids long. Let's pick an enzyme with 100 amino acids. That's a very modest enzyme. Now, a way to think of it is as a kind of necklace on which there are 100 beads. There are 20 different kinds of beads, any one of which could be in any one of these positions. To reproduce the molecule precisely, you have to put all the right beads, all the right amino acids in the molecule in the right order. If you are blindfolded while assembling a necklace from equally abundant beads, the chance of getting the right bead in the first slot is 1 chance in 20. The chance of getting the right bead in the second slot is also